I'm really happy to be able to introduce Dr. Blair Nelson to you this evening, being a fellow sort of historian of science kind of guy. A few things, though, that you should know about Dr. Nelson. So he actually got his BA in Bible and Theology from Moody Bible Institute. Then he did a BA in History from the University of British Columbia. So that's 2 degrees. Then he did a Master of Divinity from Fuller Theological Seminary. That's 3 degrees for those who are counting. And then finally, he did his PhD in History of Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His thesis director was Ron Humphreys, who some of you may know, since he's done a wealth of writing in the history of science. In the midst of that, lots of discussions about science and religion kind of relationships. The dissertation topic that Dr. Nelson worked on is actually the same title as the talk tonight, Infidel Science, Polygenism in the Mid-19th Century American Religious Press. So we are hearing from an expert on that particular sort of feature. Dr. Nelson is currently teaching history at both Benedictine University and College of DuPage. You may wonder about whether he's at the University of British Columbia. He's actually is a Canadian citizen, so that's a kind of cool thing about him. One other thing that you might find of note, really quite fascinating, is that he and his wife had marital issues over the War of 1812. So you might want to ask about that afterwards. I won't go into those things, but we had a lovely conversation about brief conversation about that at dinner tonight. So without any further ado, Dr. Blair Nelson.
Thank you. Thank you very much. By the way, my wife is here, so if you want to know how the War of 1812 can cause marital problems, her version of the story is much better than mine. Just given the difference between Canadian and Americans, probably makes a lot of sense. But I won't go any further into that. This is the very first time I've attended an event of the ASA, although I've known of your existence for a good 30 years now, so I'm delighted to put a face or faces to the name. So an exciting thing for me to be here today. The topic is this rather unusual debate that took place in the middle of the 19th century involving religion and science. So the topic should do well in dealing with theological foundations of science. But some of you may know your speaker that was scheduled to be here had to cancel, and I'm kind of pitch-hitting. So there's 2 consequences. One is my PowerPoint presentation's a little rough around the edges. It's not quite where I want it to be. And the other is I've decided I'm going to do what I want to do. I will address theology and science to a certain extent, but I have another agenda here. So I'm going to try and satisfy you. I may not succeed completely, but I'm going to try and satisfy me because I really think there's a moral to this story that is worthwhile for people of faith involved in scientific activity. Now, I know how to make this thing work. It works wonderfully. That's the abstract that was sent out to you. It was very important for me to put it up on a slide because I was shocked to find that there was a horrible grammatical error in it or a punctuation error, so I had to fix that. But if you saw the abstract, then we'll just move on from there. Historians tell stories, so I'm going to tell you the story about this controversy in the mid-19th century involving the question of the unity of the human race. Are we all descendants from one ancestor, whether it's some kind of primordial amoeba-like thing or whether it's Adam and Eve, or is each human race the result of a distinct and separate creation, which is what the theory of polygenism is about, a polygenesis. It's a debate that has been largely forgotten. And one of the things I'm going to try to convince you of tonight is that in the mid-19th century, especially in the 1850s, that was the most crucial debate involving religion and science in America. And it's one that's almost been completely forgotten. But before I tell you that story, I'm going to tell you a different story. I'm borrowing it from Louisa May Alcott. Lovely little book called 8 Cousins. Anybody ever read 8 Cousins? Oh, good. All right. 8 Cousins. It's about Rose Campbell, a 13-year-old, lovely but rather sickly and bookish young woman whose parents have died. So she shipped off to live in the house of her great aunts. Now, that's a good thing, except her great aunts live in sort of the ancestral family neighborhood. So she's surrounded by extended family, including her 7 rambunctious male cousins. So the book has a lot to do with the relationships between Rose and her seven cousins. And it all turns well in the end, with lots of moralizing and sentimentality and all those lovely Alcott things. But there's a particular story in the book that I want to tell you about. I forgot where I put my book. There it is.
Toward the end of the book, Rose is heading for the family library, where actually her father's books are,
which is her place of refuge from her rather rambunctious, testosterone-fueled cousins. And she's very disappointed that when she goes into the library, all of the boys are there, because it's raining outside. But they're not doing anything constructive. The two eldest boys are smoking cigars, and the younger boys are reading trashy novels. By trashy novels, I'm not talking about lurid things. They're young boy adventure novels, that sort of thing. So Rose, being the moral compass of her generation, starts taking a strip off them for this, and then she's reinforced by her aunt and uncle walking into the room. The boys hastily put out the cigars and repent of their terrible habit of smoking. And then there's this sort of extended moral discussion about how to behave properly. And the aunt tells the boys that they should be reading good literature. Not the trashy stuff, but good literature. And then one of the bolder boys finally complains, but you know, you really can't spend a lot of time reading because one must go out and make money. Right? You have to have a career. You can't spend all your time in the contemplative life. And then the aunt replies, this love of money is the curse of America. And for the sake of it, men will sell honor and honesty till we don't know whom to trust. And it is only a genius like Agassiz who dares to say, I cannot waste my time getting rich. Now, I'm telling you this story because my wife was sitting right there. Read this, and this is her original volume. When, what, you were 11 years old or something like that?
I was 9.
And my wife is a very good reader. She got to this character, Agassiz, and she couldn't remember him from the story. So she started at the beginning and reread, trying to find where Alcott introduces Agassiz. Here's the punchline. She doesn't. Mm. Anybody know who Agassiz is? I'm sure a couple of people do. All right. We know all about it. Whoop, too fast. Jean-Louis Rodolphe Agassiz went by his middle name Louis. Was a Swiss naturalist, descended of Protestant clergy, emigrated to America in 1846. At that time, he is arguably the most famous man of science in all of Europe. He had been patronized both by the great Georges Cuvier and by Alexander Humboldt. He had brought taxonomic order to all the fossil fish specimens in Europe. And he's known to us primarily for being the author of Ice Age theory, although his version of it's quite different than our contemporary version. Agassiz came to America in 1846. He was invited to give the prestigious Lowell Lectures in Boston and ended up staying. He was offered the first professorship at the brand new Lawrence Scientific School at Harvard. He made an enormous contribution to American science. It's hard to overestimate that contribution. The students he educated at Harvard almost completely peopled the following generation of American naturalists. I called him the Einstein of the 19th century. Not because he did physics, he did natural history. Not because he was as bright as Albert, I don't know how to adjudicate that at all. But because, as Alcott does, if you mention the name Agassiz, you don't have to explain who you're talking about. His reputation was that powerful. And he is one of the major players in the unity of mankind debate. And I'm going to use the non-gender inclusive mankind because I'm a historian and I get to use the terms from the past. He had an immense reputation both within the scientific community, educating a whole generation of naturalists, building scientific institutions. He was one of the founders of the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences, the National Academy of the Sciences. He was one of the original members. But also, he was a public figure. He was a brilliant lecturer and teacher. There's all kinds of anecdotal stories about his skills as a teacher. And he loved to engage the public. He wrote stuff for scientific journals. He wrote stuff for popular journals and magazines. And he would have public lectures all over the country. And he was charming and engaging. And it's not bad if you're an American and have a European accent. You automatically get more credibility, of course. So he was both a public figure and a scientific figure. He was also very popular to religious writers in the growing American Weekly Religious Press. And that's the database I've used to try and assess how this debate fair not in the ivory tower, but in the general American public, and specifically within the religious community in America in the 19th century, which was very, very large. To say something that's really trivial, as we're experiencing this explosion of access of information through the internet, newspaper publishing in the early 19th century was a similar phenomenon. Newspapers had been rather expensive. Individuals really couldn't afford them. The price of paper, the price of printing, the steam mechanized presses plummeted in the 1830s especially. By the time we get into the 1840s, almost every place in America, every church denomination is beginning to publish a weekly newspaper. The Methodists especially, the top title there, the Christian Advocate and Journal, is the Methodist paper from New York City. At the time, it was one of the highest circulation newspapers in the world. The one below it, the Puritan Recorder, is a Congregationalist one from Boston. These two were a couple of the most prestigious. But every place you wandered in America, somebody's buying a press and cranking up a religious newspaper. The Methodists did it officially. Every time the Methodists organized a new territory into a conference, they would elect an editor and finance a newspaper operation. Most of these were sort of spiritual entrepreneurship. Some clergy person who's ambitious, just like you get some tax-heavy pastor, sets up a website to do some cool stuff. You might get a pastor who buys a printing press and starts printing a newspaper. Often they would later get endorsed by their denomination as the official paper of the denomination. A few of these still exist. And all the ones I know that still exist are Baptists. I don't know why. And they all exist in digital format. If I remember, when I see some titles of newspapers, I'll mention which ones are still around. But the religious press loved Agassiz. Well, first of all, in the mid-19th century, in spite of all the rhetoric we have about the warfare of science and religion that historians have discarded two generations ago, that we still can't get out of our public school textbooks and, you know, regular public press, in the mid-19th century, religious people were very fond of science. This is a scientific century, and you probably are all well enough to know the advances made both in technology and science in the 19th century. For people in the Western world, this is the age of progress. This is the age of great developments, and religious thinkers see themselves as part of that. The huge missionary enterprises of the mid-19th century were hooked into improvements in transportation through steam locomotives and steam ships. Telegraphs, all these sort of new developing technologies, especially Christians saw as hooked into their job of evangelizing the world. Advances in science and technology and advances in the kingdom of God went hand in hand. There were, of course, controversies, the age of the earth and things like that, the formation of the solar system from a nebulae had been controversial things, but by the time we get to 1840, most of those issues had been settled. As a matter of fact, I've got a geological illustration there. Old Earth geology, is the Earth just a few thousand years old, or is the verse hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years old? Most of the newspapers I've followed, and I've done extensive runs of a number of these, had settled that the Earth can be as old as the geologists want it, and there's no incompatibility with the faith. As a matter of fact, even in one exchange, I think it was the Puritan Recorder, Congregationalist one, a letter was printed from a pastor attacking old earth geology in one week's issue. In the next week's issue, the editors wrote a little thing saying, well, this venerable pastor, we wanted to honor him for his service by publishing his letter, but frankly, nobody believes that anymore. Don't worry about it. Believe it or not,
things changed a little later on.
Science had a powerful role in these newspapers. When I started looking through these things, I was really honestly surprised at A, how much scientific reporting went on and its uses. The first one, apologetics. When scientific theories can be somehow shown to support theological or religious opinions, they would be trumpeted out. I don't even need to give examples for that. But they were also used for spiritual inspiration. The quotation I give you there was one that was repeated in an article that circulated through a number of these papers. Editors always have to fill up a paper every week, so you pirate stuff. Things like the New York Christian Journal and the Puritan Recorder, newspapers throughout the country would have subscriptions to them and rob stuff out of there to fill up their columns. So there was one particular column that was pirated by one newspaper from the famous Alexander von Humboldt's book Cosmos, which was a wide-selling sort of universal science of the world book. And Humboldt wrote in a very elevated, lofty tone. And so this kind of stuff was repackaged into the Christian press to edify believers. The atmosphere rise above us with its cathedral dome, reaching toward the heaven of which it is the most familiar. And that's supposed to be, I can't remember what that's supposed to be. Synonym, thank you. And symbol. Now, Alexander von Humboldt was not a Christian. He was a skeptic of anything. And these writers knew that. But they use his work because it has the right tone. They love scientific writing that seem to inspire people, that seem to conform with the general mood and rhetoric that especially the evangelical denominations, which was most of the Protestants at the time, liked. Science was also used, recommended as a pious leisurely activity. Geology especially, which a few decades before had been controversial. Now, newspapers are encouraging people to start geological cabinets, rock collectors, and especially encourage your youth to do it because it'll keep them off the streets. Boys won't waste their time playing marbles or reading trashy novels if they're collecting rocks. This points to a key issue. The explosion of newspapers in this period reflects the explosion of mass literature. Remember, before this period, the printed word is pretty expensive. And literacy rates have been growing, and we get this lovely intersection of an absolute plummeting of the cost of printed words and an increase in literacy, and printed word becomes consumer stuff. And religious writers are very concerned about what people are reading. So one of the jobs of these newspapers is to give them news of their denomination, sermon material, theological education, but is also to provide reading material that may not have any religious content, but it has the right tone and demeanor. It's good, pious leisure activity, and science qualified to a surprising degree. And Agassiz's science was just perfect. Because Agassiz had a deep faith that creation reflects the intelligence and wisdom of God. Now, for those of you that are scientists who are Christians, you're probably not going to publish a paper in a scholarly journal in which you're arguing that your latest chemistry experiment demonstrates the wisdom and goodness of God. We don't put God talk in scientific literature. By the end of the 19th century, even scientists who are Christians, of which there are many, had purged the God talk out of their literature. The early 19th century, though, God talk in scientific literature was quite normal, not at all unusual. And Agassiz, his stuff drenched with this stuff. The interesting thing about that Agassiz, though, is his God is a philosopher's God. He was a son of generations of Protestant clergy. When he came to Boston, he married into a prominent Unitarian family, rarely attended church. His God is a creator, not a redeemer. He believes that the ideas that scientists study in nature are literally ideas in the mind of a philosophical God who functions as a designer and first cause. But there's no redemptive aspect. There's nothing particularly Christian about his point of view. But that's okay, because his literature has the right tone. So Christian writers are quite happy that America's foremost man of science, this brilliant teacher, this sophisticated gentleman, writes things that they can use without any problem whatsoever, right up until 1850. Which, at, I believe it was the second meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Charleston, South Carolina, there was a paper by a Mobile physician by the name of Josiah Nott. And he wasn't attending, but the paper was read. And at the end of it, you have to understand Agassiz's influence. He was a polymath. He knew something about everything. He did important work in geology, natural history, and he tampered in many other things. His presence was so powerful that at these meetings, if he's attending a session, after the presenter is done, everybody will look to Agassiz and see what he has to say. And he usually had something to say. So after Nott's paper was presented, which was arguing for a polygenesis, was presenting scientific evidence that the various human races couldn't possibly be descendants of a single ancestor, Agassiz stands up and agrees. It was a shocking experience. Obviously, he'd been thinking about this for a while, because even before that meeting, the first of three articles that he published in the Christian Examiner, which was a Unitarian Universalist, well, Unitarian journal, but it was widely read because it was extremely well done. Even evangelicals would cite it as good reading material. Three articles he published there. The first one on the geographical distribution of animals had already been published at that point. The second one on the diversity of the origins of the human races is Agassiz's argument for human polygenism. And then the last one, The Contemplations of God in the Cosmos, is an attempt to reconcile a polygenesis with Scripture. Note that. And I'll come back to that a little bit later. This produced a crisis, an absolute crisis. Now, Agassiz was not the first American to argue for polygenism. As a matter of fact, and I'll introduce you to the rest in just a moment, there were a group of Americans beginning to push for this particular scientific point of view. A British admirer dubbed them the American School of Ethnology. It's hard to assess, but I think the best assessments are by the early 1850s, polygenism was the most powerful scientific explanation of the origin of human racial differences. So as much as it... Now, remember, this is 1850. What's going on in America having to do with race and politics in the 1850s? The compromise of 1850 as California comes into the Union, leading up to the Civil War. So this is not just abstract science and religion. This is all hooked into the fabric of American politics and social life. So this is big stuff. So let me introduce you to the rest of these guys. The first one plays an interesting role. Samuel Morton was an important physician, medical school teacher in Philadelphia. When he's trying to teach his medical students human anatomy, he's frustrated that he can't find a good textbook on the human cranium, so he decides to write his own and starts collecting human cranium. His collection is still in the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. It's known as American's Golgotha. He had about 1,000 human skulls by the time he died. What he writes is not a textbook on the human cranium. He begins comparing the cranium of different races and produces two books on ethnology based on what we might call physical anthropology. First one came out in 1839, Crania Americana. A couple of points in that book, and that page you see there is from the book, is that Native Americans are unrelated to other races. Now, he doesn't claim that he believes in polygenism in this book, but quite frankly, the arguments don't leave any other argument, any other interpretation. He also argued there was a racial hierarchy based on skull size, and he literally measured them. He would take a skull, he'd put it in a clamp that would hold it there, he'd plug up all the openings, leaving the opening where the vertebrae go in, and then he'd fill it full of buckshot, and then measure the buckshot in a graduated cylinder, and he produced this hierarchy of skull capacity in cubic inches that was profoundly influential. It's being quoted 40, 50 years later. He was smart enough to know that skull size and intelligence, there's no direct correlation. But after he makes that comment into the introduction, that sort of gets left behind. And the impression is that Caucasians are smarter because they have bigger brains. These ethnological categories are from the 19th century. Mongolian, largely Asian. Malay, Pacific Islanders, Australasians. American, meaning Native American, and Ethiopian, meaning Sub-Saharan African. Not terribly surprising for a white guy in the mid-19th century. 2 years later, he has a large collection of skulls from ancient Egypt. He's got a guy there shipping him, raiding tombs and shipping him mummies and skulls. And he studies these things and decides that the ancient Egyptians are Caucasian. Now, at the time, people had speculated that the ancient Egyptians were African, related to sub-Saharan Africans, facial features of the Sphinx and things like that. That argument is used by abolitionists as saying, if you give Africans half a chance, they can produce great civilizations. Morton says it wasn't them, that the great civilization of ancient Egypt is a Caucasian civilization. He also argues from the evidence of from monuments from ancient Egypt that seem to depict people of the same racial categories as roughly exist today, that the human racial distinctions that we experience today existed so far back in history that there wasn't time between creation and when these Egyptian monuments were made for human beings to develop this racial diversity by any natural means. Therefore, they must have been created differently. And that is one of the foundational arguments of the American School of Ethnology. Another character, and in many ways, now Morton dies in 1850 when the whole thing explodes. One of the men really driving the whole controversy is Josiah Knott. He's an elite physician. He's educated in Philadelphia, though he didn't have Morton as a teacher as far as we know. And university-educated physicians at the time were rare. They were the elite. Most physicians basically had a few months of internship, and they called themselves doctors and went and tried to heal people. He's an elite physician, and he gets interested in ethnology and publishes another major works. He's already published something as early as 1844, but in 1849, he publishes a couple of lectures that he was invited to deliver at the University of Louisiana, called Two Lectures on the Connection Between Biblical and Physical History of Man. Biblical and Physical History. Remember, this comes out in 1849, late 1849. A few months later, Agassiz makes his AAAS pronouncement and publishes his Christian Examiner articles arguing for polygenism scientifically and arguing that it can be reconciled with the reading of the Bible. So they're both dabbling on both sides of the fence here. Later, he co-publishes with George Glidden, who's the fourth member of this group that I don't say much about, the book called Types of Mankind. If you've ever heard of this debate, that's what you've heard about, 1854. It's sort of the Bible of the American polygamists. Big, fat, almost 800-page book that had a huge subscription list, went through 10 editions, sold widely. People associate it with the controversy surrounding the unity of the human race. What I'm going to argue in a moment is that the controversy began 4 years before with Knott's two lectures on the biblical and physical history of man and Agassiz's Christian Examiner articles. Quotation from Knott declaring his polygenism. Interesting thing about a polygenetic or a polygenesis explanation of human origins is it requires a creator. And it requires a number of creations. A distinct creation for each human race. All right, a few other arguments. Well, I've already made this one. I'm not going in order of story. The archaeological argument. This is an image taken from Types of Mankind, but it's the kind of argument that Morton was also making in Crania Egyptica. If you know anything about Egyptology, the whole discipline exploded in the early 19th century. When Napoleon invaded Egypt, he brought a whole herd of scientists with him. They began looking at everything. Eventually, the Rosetta Stone's discovered. They decode the hieroglyphics. And there's ripples throughout the Western world as everyone has this Egyptian mania thing. Everybody's decorating their houses with, you know, Egyptian stuff. What Knott and Glidden did when they wrote Types of Mankind, they had Glidden's wife take some of these new books on Egyptian artifacts and reproduce the drawings for them. So this is a copy of a copy. But they're arguing that what you're seeing there are three distinct human races, same categories we use today, for monuments that are at least at that point 5,000 years old. They are arguing for what we would say is an extremely short Earth history, or at least a short human history, of only maybe 10, 12,000 years. So they're arguing that there's not time between the creation of human beings and this evidence of racial diversification for this to have happened by natural means. And I'm repeating myself, so I need to go on. The other argument is the anatomical argument, that there are structural differences between the various human races. I took this off the web, but it's actually from a later book that Knott and Glidden produced called The Indigenous Races of the Earth. The political import of this illustration should be absolutely obvious to you. Comparing a Caucasian, that's actually, you know, the Apollo Belvedere from ancient Greece, with a so-called African, with an orangutan, and seeing that these differences are built into the very cranial structure, which was an argument Morton was making and they're all making. Agassiz developed a particular contribution to the argument, what I call the geographical argument. Agassiz noticed, and you biologists can tell me if I've even got this close to right in terms of modern biology, that if you pick any species of animal and look at the range, what part of the earth it inhabits, pick another species in that area and look at their range, the ranges are generally about the same. What you might call climactic zones or something like that. Agassiz called them zoological provinces. He was especially, Agassiz's specialty was ichthyology, fish, and he was especially struck that you find different species of fish kind of grouped in the same range in the oceans where there are no natural barriers whatsoever. His explanation for this is that God created species. He's a fixities species creationist for these climactic zones, in these climactic zones. Now, before he came to America, this was his standard explanation for the geographical distribution of animals. At that point, he believed it didn't apply to human beings, because human beings are all over the earth. When he comes to America in the 1840s, he goes to visit Samuel Morton. Morton convinces him, apparently, that this is true of human beings as well. So, in Types of Mankind, which begins with an article by Agassiz, we have this chart. Each column of the chart represents a zoological province. At the top, the typical human being belonging to that province, divided by races, their skull formation, and then a collection of particular plants. So this is Europe with a fine-looking Caucasian. This is the Arctic with a rather ugly-looking Eskimo. This is the Native Americans, Sub-Saharan Africans, Malays, subcontinent folks, and there's a couple other colors I couldn't put on the slide. So Agassiz factors his zoological province argument into a human polygenesis. Now, not surprisingly, clergy answered this. The most important is the Reverend John Backman. I'm not going to keep track of time here. Who is a pastor of St. John's Lutheran in Charleston, South Carolina. Charleston, South Carolina was the epicenter of this debate. Before it became a public debate, intellectuals at Charleston had been debating this for about 5 years. Agassiz had a number of friends there. He used to visit them once in a while and participate in these debates. And some of the most important polygenists that weren't directly involved with the American School of Ethnology were in the Charleston area. But this same group of people also had a couple of very prominent clergy. Backman is the most important one. Morton had been writing in some scientific journals more of this polygenist stuff. Backman had been answering him. They'd been carrying on a debate in one of the elite scientific journals. The interesting thing about Backman is he's not just a clergyman, he's a parson scientist, which was a little rare in America, but quite common in England at the time. Clergymen were also first-class men of science. In fact, Backman is a close friend of John Audubon. As a matter of fact, three of Backman's daughters married three of Audubon's sons. They're not one. And Backman really is one of the leading American zoologists. Viviparous Quadrupeds of the United States was a volume. J.J. Audubon had slipped into dementia at that point, so his two eldest sons produced an Audubon volume on quadrupeds. Backman wrote the text. He is a world-renowned scientist, recognized. Charles Darwin admired his work. So when he is answering, he's answering as a scientist. And he produces the first book-length refutation, which comes out in 1850. Clearly he'd been working on this based on the debates in Charleston before Knott and Agassiz's articles start driving the public debate. The other guy who's important here is the Reverend Thomas Smith. He's a Presbyterian minister, also in Charleston, South Carolina. He is really a gentleman scholar, a polymath, writes mountains of stuff. He writes a book-length treatment that comes out before Backman's. His is written more from the point of view of the clergy. He draws a lot on the scientific arguments about Backman, but he's not a scientist himself. His particular contribution I'll talk about in a few minutes, because I'm more concerned with the public side of the debate than I am concerned with the elite literature. Okay, I promised you we talk about theology and science. We're going to talk about ideas. I've given you the polygenist arguments. Now I'm going to give you the monogenist arguments, the people who believe, for scientific reasons, that we are descended from some common ancestor. First of all, is the gradation of human types. Polygenists believe that humans are created separately in separate places. There are distinct differences between these human types or races. The monogenists say, well, if you really look at it, they kind of grade one into another. Well, the polygenists said that's because of intermarriage. These are human hybrids, but there are discrete differences between the races, so they're arguing the question of gradation between the races. Hybrid interfertility, since the days of Buffon in the 18th century, the question of whether two animals can breed together is an indication of whether they're on the same species. This was a disputed but fairly standard indicator of two creatures being the same species, and the Americans self-supplied lots of evidence. The Caucasians and Africans could produce offspring. As a matter of fact, Knott, Josiah Knott, spent mountains of ink trying to argue that yes, a white master can have children with his black slave, but the offspring are deficient. He says they are fertile in the first generation, their fertility dies out by the fourth generation, so they're kind of like mules. Okay. And he spends a lot of ink arguing that, largely in anecdotal evidence. The question is, can human beings by natural means diversify into different races quickly enough, given everybody working with a fairly short human history? So the monogenists are coming up with all kinds of evidence that human beings in the early days of human existence, their population increased rapidly, the assumption that diversification would increase quickly as well. And I've got lots of lovely stories that we don't have time for. Evidence of adaptation to environment. The trouble with that is that that evidence was getting pretty weak. Sub-Saharan Africans had been living in the United States in a different environment than Sub-Saharan Africa now for centuries. They don't look much different. Caucasians from Northern Europe have been living in the American South in a very different environment than people in Germany or England, and they still look the same as the people back home. So the monogenists are working very hard to try and find some evidence for that. It's not going so well. Actually, the most powerful evidence is something connected less to what we would call physical anthropology than cultural anthropology. There's a huge industry in tracing the branches of human languages. The Indo-European branch of science had only been recently been of language had been defined. And the notion is, as human beings have diversified, their languages diversified with them. So if you can trace languages back into groups and families to an ancestor language, that's evidence of what the polygenists say are distinct human groups once upon a time living together and sharing the same linguistic background. Very prominent British ethnologists at the time are pursuing that line of reasoning. There are religious issues. You can guess what they are. What do we do with the scheme of salvation, especially the Pauline language of Jesus being our Redeemer because he's the second Adam, able to redeem the sins of the offspring of the first Adam? If we're not all offspring of the first Adam, does the gospel extend to these other races? A guy like Josiah Knott would largely say no. There's also mythological consequences. This is the period of this fantastic Protestant enterprise of attempting to evangelize the world. Missionaries are sailing out all over the world. If these other people groups are not related to Adam and Eve, and therefore are not eligible to be blessed by the gospel, what's the point? So this is this hits people at home. And then the last one is the veracity of the Bible. Doesn't the Bible teach that we are all one big happy family? And I added the title slide there, quotation from Paul's Mars sermon about, you know, about the unity of human blood. Well, that's where it gets really tricky. Now, we've got the ingredients for a controversy, right? This may look like a lovely controversy between religion and science. We have the scientists, the polygenists, and as of 1850 or so, they seem to be having the strongest argument. Then we have the clergy answering back. And in case you're tempted to go that route, I want to dissuade you right off the bat. Well, I should make the point, yes, there was a controversy. A few slides here just showing you these articles. These are in weekly Christian newspapers that show up in the parlor of the kitchen of families all across America. In the 1840s, I'll tell you that later. But articles such as this, Agassiz and Adam, about Agassiz's polygenism. And some of these are hard to see. The unity of the human race. The unity of the races. A few examples. I have in my filing cabinet hundreds of these. Hundreds of these. So we have this classic conflict. I've already said this part, haven't I? But it's a complicated thing. And forgive the goofy type. I had a PowerPoint presentation for a very different audience I'm adapting, and I haven't made it look sophisticated for you folks. So it's a little silly. It is complex. As I told you, John Bachman did not write as a clergyman. He wrote as a scientist, and he was a first-class scientist. So we do have scientists answering scientists. The problem for the monogenists is Batten's the only one replying in the 1850s. The famous geology Dana published something toward the end of the 1850s, but through most of that decade, the rest of the scientific community was almost completely silent on the issue, which is why I think we've forgotten this. We look for these debates in the scholarly literature. It didn't exist there. And my theory is most of the American scientific community were religious and probably didn't like this. We really don't know how many bought into polygenism. We have a few other names. But most of them were absolutely silent on this. And I think the answer is they couldn't stomach polygenism. However, they didn't have an answer for it, a scientific answer, and they weren't going to go fight it on religious principles because they're men of science. So Bachman really stood alone for quite a period of time. But so while the scientific community was very quiet about this, the public press was drenched in these things. You can take almost any newspaper or journal from 1850 on, they don't have to look very far for an article on the unity of the human. In these articles, these religious writers largely fight science with science, but that's not the only thing they're doing. A couple of points that are interesting here. The religious writers who fought for human unity, the theory that they're largely using is what we call environmentalist monogenism or monogenism. There's more than one way to pronounce it. They claim that we are all descendants of Adam and Eve, or even Noah's family, because everybody else got wiped out, right? How did we diversify? As people groups spread to different geographical areas, different environments, they changed in response to the environment, which is exactly what Bachman's arguing for. Now here's the interesting irony. These guys are half an inch away from evolution. They don't believe of evolution of the species, but they believe of the evolution within the species into varieties under the pressures of the environment. In other words, they have one creation and it's all natural. The polygenists have a whole bunch of creations and nothing evolving. So, matter of fact, when Agassiz dies in 1873, he's one of the last remaining American men of science who is fighting against evolution. He goes down fighting. He never buys into it. So it is a complicated thing. The sad thing about telling stories of religion and science and the propaganda behind, you know, religion always holding back science is you always point to these issues where the science eventually kind of won. We believe in an old Earth. We believe in evolution. This is one where the science lost. There is one, thankfully. Polygenism didn't succeed. So that makes the story, I think, a little more complicated. All right, but I really want to talk about the public part of it. So I've answered, hopefully I've talked about science and theology. I've satisfied you a little bit. I'm running out of time, so I've got to go quickly here. I'm going to make this point quickly. There's lots more slides, but I'm going to plow through these and go to the punchline. The historical question, I'm not a scientist or a theologian, I'm a historian, is why did it happen then? And that's an important question. Polygenism had been around for a while. Since the late 1700s especially, certain European scholars are beginning to suggest it, and there were Americans earlier in the 19th century that had been pressing it. Dusignan himself had published early in the 1840s some clear-cut polygenist arguments. And yet the religious press ignored it. I had surveyed a number of newspapers all the way through the 1840s. I actually began with 1839 to see if they noticed Morton. They don't, but Morton's book is a technical scientific piece. Knott's work is always more popular. They don't even notice. There are a couple times they mention it, but it's not a problem. It's just an interesting thing to talk about. And then, by March of 1850, we go from two or three articles in all the religious press in 1840 to almost weekly articles in the major American weeklies for the balance of 1850, and then it peters off. But into the 1870s, articles on the unity of mankind keep popping up. They're on the radar. And if the scientific ideas were there before, why does the popular debate begin at the time that it does? And that's what I'm really concerned about. And here's why I'm concerned about it. Because we can argue how religion and science intersect in the ivory tower all we want. But if we don't figure out how that works in the larger public sphere, we're not getting any traction, are we? So this isn't a debate that actually took place more in the public sphere, more in the newspapers of farmers and insurance salesmen and housewives than it did in the ivory tower. So it's a good case to do this. I'm going to have to go pretty quickly here. Here's why it happened then. as I said before, Knott and Agassiz both argue that Pelagianism is reconcilable with a reading of the Bible. And you can scratch your head and say, how could that be? An exegetical theory we call pre-atomism, it's been around since the 17th century. Isaac de la Pereire, who was a French-Jewish scholar, rather radical man. He's actually credited with one of the founders of modern biblical criticism by his use of this. He argues, actually more from Romans than from Genesis, that the Bible does not teach that Adam and Eve are the parents of everybody. Adam and Eve are only the parents of one group of people. For Pereire, it's the Jews, because he has this Jewish apocalyptic thing in which the French king becomes sort of a Davidic Messiah, and with the help of the Jews in France, brings in the kingdom of God. It's a little bizarre stuff. Agassiz and Knott pick up on this, and they repackage it. Adam and Eve are the parents of, you tell me, guess who? Caucasians. Is there any biblical evidence of other people? Well, there are some odd stories in Genesis. You see, you read a few chapters into Genesis, and you get this, there's all kinds of people there who aren't part of an Adam and Eve's family, are they? You know, when Cain kills Abel, and he goes away, and he founds a city, where did those people come from? Well, that's where they came from. They were already there. They were pre-Adamic human beings. So Knott and Agassiz take this exegetical theory, they wave it in front of everybody and say, see, you can be a Pelagianist and you can be a good Christian and read your Bible. Trouble is, the clergy weren't buying that. One is, who do these guys think they are telling us how to read the Bible? It was a boundary dispute. It was fine. If scientists do science, we, the clergy, will help people understand it and understand why it's not a threat. When scientists start telling us how to interpret the Bible, though, that's not going so far. Pereire had a reputation as a heretic. As a matter of fact, he was forced by the Vatican to denounce this opinion. And the clergy vaguely knew of him and his ideas, and they were on the bad side. So now we have two scientists, one of them being Louis Agassiz, the most prominent scientist on the continent, telling people how to interpret their Bible and using an exegetical theory that is largely held to be heretical. My title, Infidel Science, I will skip past that. Go back to what I said at the beginning. And I'm going to wrap this up quickly. I won't be able to get through all the slides because I want time for questions. I'm supposed to finish about 8, right? Am I going over time? Okay. So I'm going to go to the punch here. As I said, science was very popular with religious writers. These 19th century newspapers have all kinds of interesting scientific stuff that's supposed to be edifying, pious leisure activity. Except they are patrolling for what they call infidel science. Because there are those so-and-sos out there, those troublemakers, who press scientific ideas to attack religion. So by infidel, there's a very specific use of the word. An infidel is not just somebody who doesn't believe. When these people call somebody an infidel is an aggressive person who's trying to undermine other people's faith. Tom Paine is one of their favorites. Tom Paine, great American hero of the Revolution, Common Sense, celebrated as this great man that helped the Americans throw off, you know, the British. We'll get back to the War of 1812 later on. But then Tom Paine wrote Age of Reason, which is a scathing, skeptical, and nasty attack on revealed religion. He's an infidel. That's what they're worried about. Agassiz and Knott both get labeled infidels at this point. Now, for Knott, he can wear the label well because he was. He had sort of an Enlightenment theism. He felt that the traditional clergy had to be halfway to brain dead to believe what they believed. George Glidden, the guy he wrote Types of Mankind with, who's an Englishman, grew up in Cairo. His family were merchants. They had business there. Actually, he and his father had been hired by the Americans to be their consul in Egypt. He's the one shipping Egyptian skulls to Morton. He comes to America and makes a reputation with this traveling Egypt show. He's got these public lectures about Egypt stuff. And then he meets Knott, and they write this stuff together. If you read Glidden's writing, actually, it's great fun to read because he's one of the most pompous so-and-sos you'll ever meet. I mean, he's just dripping with this self-indulgent pride and just ridiculing. A third of Types of Mankind is written by Glidden. It's got nothing to do with ethnology. It's telling people how to interpret the Bible. He thinks he's bringing the latest European biblical scholarship to these ignorant Americans. So this was an infidel attack on the faith. The problem is Agassiz. You see, Agassiz, what do you do with Agassiz? His tone is much nicer than these two, and yet he's still arguing pre-atomism. And Agassiz,
they would really like to keep him on their side because he is producing good quality science, and he has all this lovely God talk about his science, reveals the wisdom of God in creation. They would really like to have both. What I would show you, if I have time for the rest of the slides, is that in these short newspapers, they don't have time to bring all the technical arguments in, right? I mean, you people spend years educating your students in chemistry, biology, and things. You can't take a newspaper article and give all your years of learning to somebody who reads it over their coffee at breakfast. It's the same problem. Their readers aren't prepared for this stuff. So these writers have to package this stuff in a rhetoric that is not so much didactic, teaching people what to think. It's pastoral. It's encouraging people, yes, there's a controversy. There are these nasty, infidel scientists using scientific authority to attack your faith, but it's okay, and here's why. They give some of the scientific arguments, it's rather piecemeal. But there are some rhetorical practices that they have honed in the past from old controversies, one of which is to attack the credentials of the scientists. Real scientists wouldn't be saying these things. It's only a dilettante will say this. Knott's a good target. He's actually quite well educated, but he's nothing like Agassiz. Trouble is, you can't say that of Agassiz. It won't fly. They also point to sciences when they're young are very speculative. And it's much easier for an infidel scientist to take this speculative theory and use it to attack religion. As a scientific discipline matures and becomes more empirical, if you know what Baconian views on, you know, anti-speculative philosophy, there's Baconianism going on here, that as sciences mature, they will reconcile themselves to the faith. It happened with nebular theory, it happened with geology, all their lovely shiny happened with astronomical theory. It will happen with ethnology if we just don't panic and give it time. So they argue from history. These things always play out fairly well in the end. So they're deploying this kind of rhetoric. But they're having trouble with Agassiz because they can't paint him as a dilettante.
Let's see if I've got a slide that will help with this.
A little bit of the language they use. And that bottom one there is a quotation from Types of Mankind toward the latter part of the book. And the development of science will have rendered any new translation altogether super... Erogatory amongst the educated who are creating new religions for themselves. If you're educated, you're going to discard traditional Christianity. That alone paints them as infidels. So, in 1850, explosion of articles dealing with this. People are almost panic-stricken trying to deal with this. Religious writers are trying to tell the general reading Christian public why you're going to hear about this stuff, calm down, someday it'll go away. Here's some arguments to help you along the way. After 1850, it tends to peter off. Types of Mankind is published in 1854. There's another spike, but you know it's nothing new. So they kind of peter off, but they remain in the literature because now they're a standard part of this war on infidelity. And this is the only infidel science they have, so they have to write about it. Geology's okay now, astronomy's okay now, so we've got infidelity. By the mid-1870s, it is gone. You know, I've got some slides, but I'm not going to show them to you because I need to wrap this up. Why did it end? Anybody want to guess? Why did it end?
Battle with evolution.
Evolution. And you find scholars who say evolution. Evolution is decidedly monogenistic. Now, you probably know in types of in Origin of Species, Darwin doesn't talk about human beings. He's got like one or two throwaway lines. He saves that until 1871 when he publishes Descent of Man. Chapter 7 of Descent of Man is entitled The Races of Man. It has a full-blown attack on the polygynous. It names not Agassiz. It celebrates Batman. Darwin mans up. Jim Moore and Adrian Desmond, a couple of the prominent Darwin scholars today, published a book a few years ago called Darwin's Sacred Cause. And they argue that the reason why Darwin risked his reputation to publish evolutionary theory, which was dangerous religiously, which Darwin probably didn't care about, was also dangerous politically and socially. And read the book to find out that stuff. But because Darwin was a dyed-in-the-wool abolitionist and racial egalitarian, and he felt morally driven. I don't think that argument works for Origin of Species. It's just too speculative. It clearly works for Descent of Man. The very structure of the book reflects that. Darwin is out to argue for human evolution, but I'm sure the reason why he's doing that is to give an account of human racial diversity that is monogenistic and can be egalitarian, as opposed to producing a racial hierarchy. That, I think, is the whole purpose behind Darwin's Descent of Man. But when Darwin publishes Origin of Species, he's already famous by then. The Journal of the Voyages of the HMS Beagle was a good seller. People respect him. Very few newspapers even notice the book. Most of them go, I'm not sure about evolutionary theory. Interesting, a handful of them say, well, if he's right, the polygenists are wrong. And the most interesting newspaper that makes that note is the Christian Recorder, that's published under Mother Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Philadelphia. They noticed that. But Darwin is almost not noticed. And what's interesting is it takes a while for people to see that evolution theory even answers this. Again, Darwin doesn't publish on this until 1871. In the early years, as his theory is propagating, there are polygenists in England who love him, because they look at the struggle for existence and they say, see, that's race warfare. See, the polygenists explained European hegemony around the world as the natural superiority of the Caucasians, that when an inferior race comes into contact with a superior race, it inevitably leads to conflict. The superior race will win. That's struggle for survival. So they're kind of missing the point that he's really a monogenist. So Darwinism isn't what drives it out. The religious press barely notice it, and not many people notice off the bat, except for a couple of religious writers, that Darwin's really on their side. And evolutionary theory is still too iffy at this point. Well, it's a public debate. It's a newspaper. Newspapers are only so big. These are generally large sheets, but only one big sheet folded, 4 pages. And you only got so much space. You have to deal with everything, from when your local bishop's visiting, to the weather, to advice to farmers and what to plant, to the latest Sunday school lesson, and oh, my little bit on science for this week. What happens, I believe, well, I know this, is that new infidels pop up and drive the old infidelity off the page. Now, the thing about the polygenists is there are never many of them, but because the scientific community wasn't answering back, they looked like they were the whole thing. But there are really only maybe 6 or 8 of them that I know of. Only 4 of them are active, and they don't really generate any disciples. George Glidden dies in the mid-1850s. He's shipped off to Panama. He was constantly out of money. And so another scientist who was involved in a commercial venture in Panama sends him there to do some bureaucratic work. He catches the fever, takes an overdose of opium, and he's gone. Morton dies in 1850, so he's really gone before the thing begins. Agassiz rarely publishes anything on this after 1854, the article he has in Types of Mankind. Actually, he's got another one in Indigenous Races of the Earth, which is a few years later. The evidence is he keeps talking about it in public lectures, but he doesn't publish anything else because it's not what he's about. Knott goes down fighting for a while, but then the Civil War comes, and he is so completely demoralized by it that he just shuts up. As a matter of fact, he ends up sending a letter to General Howard, who's in charge of the Freedmen's Bureau after the war, one of these institutions in Reconstruction to try and help the liberated slaves sort themselves out, you know, build schools, get them going. And Knott writes a letter to them. And Knott's keeping up with the science. He says, okay, maybe Darwin's right. But if they're going to improve and become like us someday, Darwin's evolution moves so slowly that everything you're doing right now is a complete and utter waste of time. You know, different drum, but the same beat. All right. Who are the infidels that push them off the page? I'm going to zip along to the end. I've got all kinds of fun things to say here. There we go. Know anything about these two guys? Thomas Henry Huxley, Darwin's bulldog, pushing evolution like crazy. He wants to make it the litmus test for a real scientist in England during a period when science is less the leisurely activity of gentlemen and it's beginning to get things like state sponsorship. It's beginning to have real cash, commercial, and political value. And Huxley wants to make sure that people like him are in control of who's getting these new juicy jobs in science. And what he's trying to do is make sure that none of these people are parson naturalists, none of these people are clergy, because he doesn't think these people are bona fide scientists. So he takes the rhetoric of the warfare of science and religion to tell the church to stay out of science. And it's vicious rhetoric. And I don't have time to show you some quotations, but it's powerful stuff. His buddy, John Tyndall, the Irish physicist, especially known for the Belfast Address at the British Association for the Advancements of Science, in which he laid down the gauntlet and said, if you have religious faith, stay out of science. You have no business there. What they're trying to do is fully secularize science. The church had been one of the major patrons of scientific activities since the Middle Ages. But these guys want to remove it from there, largely so that the upcoming generation of young scientists don't have to have any theological tests in order to get the juicy new jobs that are happening. But that's a whole other story. But from the mid-1870s, these guys are the infidel scientists, and they're the ones that are getting the front page news. Now, did I leave anybody out? Come on. What about Darwin? And this is the beginning of another story, but I can't resist telling you this. I'm convinced from reading these newspapers that the nasty reputation Darwin got was inherited from these guys. Because they were using Darwinian evolution as the litmus test, he got caught up in this infidel science war. And I'm not sure it would have happened if these two hadn't attached his name to it. Now, Darwin himself didn't care very much. But when these guys first come up on the radar, as a matter of fact, earlier in their careers, before they start publishing this stuff, they are heroes to our religious writers. They are just quoting these guys all over the place. They're doing great science, this lovely pious stuff. It's well worth paying attention to. And then Huxley's piece on protoplasm, that life has natural origins, not supernatural origins. Tyndall's Belfast address. And then these religious writers realize these guys are a problem. They're like Agassiz. They're credentialed scientists who are now using their science to attack religion. But they don't pay any attention to Darwin, not at the beginning. It takes a few years before it goes from Huxley and Tyndall to Huxley, Tyndall, and Darwin. And I think Darwin just got caught up in that wave because of the way they were using it. I'm not sure. I like to think, I mean, you never know what would have happened, as C.S. Lewis liked to say. If you read the Narnia books, right, Aslan, you never know what would have happened. If Huxley and Tyndall had not started their war against religious authority, perhaps Darwin would have been celebrated as the scientific defender of monogenes. I really think that's a possibility. And that's the end.
Well, thank you, Bob. So we've got time for questions. So
I didn't go too far.
No, this is fine. So. Yes.
Did Agassiz comment on the Darwin theories?
He fought them to his death.
But he did fight them all.
Yes. He is a dyed-in-the-wool creationist, a philosophical creationist. And when he dies in 1873, there's only about two credentialed men of science in America that are still fighting it. He's one of them. As a matter of fact, there's a famous article in the Atlantic Monthly. Interesting. In the latter part of Agassiz's life, he publishes more in the popular press than he does in the scientific press. He's begun to alienate himself from his own scientific community. Also, as I said, he educated almost the entire next generation of naturalists, who all, as a man, go over to evolution eventually. But Agassiz goes down fighting. He dies in 73. Early in 74, the last thing he wrote, this article in Atlantic Monthly, is his last attack on Darwinism. The religious writers love this. Because by then, Darwin's been demonized, in the pattern I've told you. So Agassiz's reputation, strangely, gets rehabilitated. When he dies in 73, and then that article comes out, there are obituaries in the religious press celebrating this great man, almost ignoring his polygenism. Actually, I have one where they say, oh yeah, he kind of screwed up in the 50s when he went on the wrong track there, but everything else is great. So he gets redeemed in this in kind of an ironic way. Yeah.
I'd love your thoughts on this. I've done some research on the history of science here at Wheaton College. Jonathan Blanchard, our founder, in 1860, corresponded with Agassiz.
Oh, really?
Visited him and took his recommendation for a person to hire to teach natural science here.
Well, Agassiz was a power player because he was educating. I mean, if you really wanted a career in science, you went and studied with Agassiz. Agassiz had the power to place you. Yeah, people are always deferring to his advice.
But what makes me wonder about it wasn't so much his Unitarianism, but with Blanchard being evangelical, but the fact that Blanchard was an avid abolitionist, and he must have known about this this controversy.
Well,
because he was widely read in the science.
Yeah. It's interesting, and there's so much that borns out. The way the story works, because Knott publishes first in the South, it's the Southern press that reacts first. When Agassiz publishes in the Northern press, gets involved. The Northern press virtually ignores Knott. They don't know him, they don't care about him. He's just a nut. Agassiz is a serious problem. But you see, Agassiz wasn't as aggressive as Knott, either socially or religiously.
Agassiz, you know, he's living in Boston. I mean, he's constantly milking the wealthy Bostonians for money to all kinds of scientific ventures. He doesn't want to alienate the abolitionists. And he really doesn't comment much about it, although I think secretly he's not worried about slavery. He's also good friends with these southern slave owners. He goes to visit the plantations to do ethnological work. So Agassiz just doesn't comment on the politics of it. As a matter of fact, he seems strangely naive of it. Although he sort of uses this pre-atomism and gets labeled an infidel for a brief period of time, he doesn't press it. And he doesn't package it the way Notton and Glidden do. They are infidels. They're out to undermine your faith. Agassiz, he might think as an evangelical you're naive, but he's not interested in attacking. And if you show an interest in science, he's like a kid in a candy shop. So he's less concerned about things. He really is purely a man of science. An interesting individual. I exhausted you.
Well, thank you for your patience.
Oh, Blair, as I recall, I think in terms of the monogenes, you're talking about there was some notion of people changing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From that. Any idea of mechanistically, you know, what kind of mechanisms that were thought about in terms of change, or was it just...
There was there's a very strong tradition in environmental influences coming out of the 18th century. Montesquieu's book on law saying that even human institutions, legal institutions, and civil structures of civilizations are produced in response to the environment. Exact mechanisms, who knows? But people are looking for correlations, and the environment really plays a big role. It begins to lose ground in the early 19th century. As a matter of fact, Samuel Stanhope Smith, who was a scholar at Princeton College, back when it was College of New Jersey, eventually succeeds Witherspoon as the president of the college. He wrote a book on ethnology came out about 1809, 1810, arguing monogenistic environmentalism. And he thinks he's got evidence of it. Chemistry of the skin, things like that. You know, they're trying to explore these things. They don't have any direct correlations, but, you know, they're claiming that they're finding at least anecdotal evidence of people changing. I can't remember the name. There's a famous case of an African-American gentleman that apparently got some kind of a skin disease, and his skin began to turn white, patches. Well, Smith would point to that and say, see, here's evidence. He's changing in response to the environment. He would note, Smith would argue that domestic slaves in the South look more European than the field slaves, and he would argue it's because they're living within the manor, they're living in the environment, now more social environment, than the field hands. Samuel Cartwright, who's one of the early polygenists, says, you idiot, they were chosen because they're better looking by European standards. So it's all anecdotal, but a lot of natural history at this point is anecdotal. So, you know, I mean, the collection mechanisms you have now really didn't exist.
It sounds a little Lamarckian in terms of acquired characteristics, but I don't know how much influence that idea.
That's a good question, and I don't know enough about the early stuff. I honestly don't know if Smith would claim. See, Lamarck got humiliated, and people aren't wanting to throw his name around. Course, he gets revived in the end of the 19th century. American evolution is largely Lamarckian until the 1930s. Yeah. I can't remember. I'm looking at the newspapers, and Lamarck's name's not going to pop up because he's just too obscure for the average reading public. But that it could be some Lamarckian elements in there. Mm-hmm. But you can be an environmentalist and not be a Lamarckian as well. Yeah?
From this debate and stuff that was going on at that time, are there some lessons that the church community can apply to, say, the Dawkins of this world or other infidels, modern infidels? What lessons can we learn and apply?
Well, yeah, that's the moral that I obviously needed to say a little more, is that we do need to pay attention to the public debate. And we need to look at how it operates, because it operates differently than the ivory tower debate. And when you're writing to colleagues in the ivory tower, you want convincing scientific arguments, theological arguments. But what do you say to the average person in the pew who at best gets little snippets of things that are sort of repackaged for popular consumption? And that's why I think this is an interesting case study, because that's where this thing existed. And the fact that it ended not because there was any real resolution, and I'm sure the polygynists never really got any traction in the churches anyway, and in the long run they never really had much influence, but that it was displaced by another controversy.
I mean, I think we need to understand that dynamic. Because that's where most of us as Christians encounter these things. Not in the ivory towers of Wheaton College, but just picking up bits and pieces of things through popular writings and, you know, what's said from the pulpit. So I think we do need to pay more attention to that. Maybe what we need to be doing is start analyzing how science is depicted in the popular press today, both the religious and secular popular press. I don't know if anyone's really studied that. It's not going to be learned in journal articles, is it? So that's a dynamic that I think we need to pay attention to. That's how this is my agenda. See, that's not a technical theology and science. That's popular communication, right?
I'd love to hear a little bit more about Bachman's biography. I was struck by the fact that so much of this debate began in Charleston, South Carolina. You made an argument that because of the experience of miscegenation, people realized that probably Africans and Europeans kind of, you know, were the same species.
Yep.
But without actually more background, I just don't even know. Is Bachman from South Carolina? Was he educated there?
No, he's from New Jersey, I think.
Okay, so this is interesting.
He's a transplant. But he is a Southerner. He supports the Confederacy.
Yeah.
His wife is a Southerner. When he married her, I think they had 4 or 5 domestic slaves. But he's they're all racist, okay? It's almost impossible to find the European American period in this period who isn't racist by your cultural standards, okay? That's just a given.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's racist and racist. Not is a nasty one. He really thinks Africans are absolutely substandard. Any attempt to elevate them is a complete racism. Bachman, on the other hand, there is a story, there's a biography made by Lester Stevenson, and there's this lovely story of a young African American man who's gotten educated. He's interested in naturalism. He goes to visit Bachman in his home to learn. Bachman hosts him, has him in his parlor, which we normally do. They're discussing natural history. Then he invites his daughter to come in and play the piano to entertain him. Now, that's a level of hospitality you give to an equal in this culture. Thomas Smith is actually born in Scotland. His family moved to New Jersey. He's educated in Princeton. He gets called to the church in South Carolina. He supports the Confederacy. He's got no great argument with slavery, but he's one of the first people to have Africans in his church in South Carolina. Now, granted, the Africans are up in the gallery. They're not sitting with European Americans, but he's one of the first people in that city to actually bring Africans into his church at the same time that the white folk were. So these guys are racist too, but they're not exactly like Knott, who's got no use for anybody but himself. So there's degrees. Yeah. There are racists and racists.
It's also just interesting that their educational trajectory is interesting, right?
Yeah. Anyone else? Yep.
How do these events affect how Christians interact with science?
Oh boy, that's an excellent question. And I don't have a direct answer. I think the way I've described the newspapers, that these newspapers were very pro-science, but it has to be science done right. And if you ever heard the metaphor of the two books, that God reveals through Scripture and through nature, they have to agree because they come from the same source. That language of the two books is just salted everywhere through these newspapers. I mean, nobody can read these things without getting the sense that, yes, science done correctly will agree with the faith interpreted correctly will agree with science. So, if anything, I think in the long run, the collapse of religionism, its failure to really get a lot of traction, religious writers point to and say, see, there's a science that you can't reconcile, and it peters out, and even the scientists reject it. But you see, I don't see them saying that very much because of the way it peters out. And it's complicated by the fact that the religionists don't have any disciples. You know, when writers in the religious newspapers are talking about this stuff in the late 1860s, the early 1870s, none of the religionists are being public about this anymore. You know, Agassiz's busy fighting evolution. Notch just depressed and hiding out, not doing much of anything. So there's not much traction there. So had the religionists produced disciples and kept pressing it, maybe a better case study to sort that out. And then again, Tyndall and Huxley splash under the pages as the new infidels. So the same rhetoric's being used. There is a development, and this may not be answering your question. The notion that bad infidel scientists are also bad scientists. They're dilettantes. The true scientists will always be a people of faith. And in the early 19th century, they can march out all sorts of names. David Brewster's hagiographic biography of Isaac Newton that paints him as a saint had come up. So they're pointing to Isaac Newton. They're pointing to all these great scientists. Say, see, if you're really a scientist, you're going to be a Christian. Agassiz makes a serious problem for them. So I'm not 100% sure of this, but with Agassiz, you know, not in Glidden, they're dilettantes. They're not real scientists. You can't argue with Agassiz's credentials, so they start fencing him in. He may be right about science. When he starts interpreting scripture for us, he's out of bounds. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And it's convenient that Agassiz doesn't press Pelagianism very much. But then that technique of taking credentialed scientists that are attacking the faith and limiting them to their science is what they do with these two. That their statements about the relationship within science and religion are beyond their expertise as scientists. Now they're philosophizing, and they're not allowed to do that. I'll listen to Huxley talk about biology. I'll listen to Tyndall talk about physics. When they tell me how science and religion rate, they're not qualified to talk about that. So intellectual boundaries become more important to people in the long run. So I think that's, I would like to see if that's a technique that continues on into the early 20th century.
This is kind of an impression I have that maybe kind of not historical or historical, but it seems like a lot of Christians not only rejected the Jones, Huxley, and Tyndall's take on faith and science, but they weren't even able to listen to science.
Boy, that's a hard one. Before Huxley and Tyndall had revealed their colors, they were celebrated in the religious press. People loved what they did. I think because they're able to separate them off through these boundary arrangements, they're able to expropriate the science while rejecting the rhetoric of the conflict of science and religion. Now, whether that... I haven't really looked in the newspapers to see how much that comes through in the writing there, because they're so freaking angry at these guys at the time. It's just... it's over the top. But does the general religious public start? I mean, how do you answer that question? That would take a huge historical survey to answer. And it probably varies from place to place. What I haven't told you about is that this debate has geographical elements to it. You don't see it being talked about much in Tennessee or in Texas. The epicenters are Charleston, which was the center of Southern religious scientific activity, Philadelphia, a center of scientific activity, New York, and Boston. So where the religious press is closest to the functioning scientific community, that's where it gets the most. The further you get away from the centers of scientific activity, the less and less you see awareness in these papers of the debate. So it depends where you live. And it's not a north-south thing. It's Charleston is the center of it both religiously and scientifically at the beginning, as is New Orleans, actually, which was a major scientific center as well. Am I helping you? I don't feel I'm really answering your questions.
What I'm trying to understand is, like, the historical roots of American or Christian American faith and rejection evolution.
Yeah.
Because that's something, you know, Huxley would hammer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the trouble with historians is they're allergic to really large categories.
Yeah.
I mean, Christian Americans. There's a huge diversity there. Unitarians don't have much trouble with Agassiz or his polygenism. They barely notice it. They may not really like it, but they don't worry about it, but it's not important to them. The evangelicals attack it tooth and claw, and they're the majority in the middle of the 19th century. End of the 19th century, now we've got a lot of Catholics here. We've got more diversity within Protestant denominations. You're going to see differences. The Catholic press, I follow at least one of the Catholic newspapers, don't pay any attention to this or any attention to science because they're too busy trying to establish Catholicism in America. So there's a lot of individual contexts that make a question, what do Christian Americans think? A lot of things. I mean, I think that's always going to be true. You have to be careful about a stereotype that just because these people are Christian or a certain kind of Christian, that they have such and such attitudes towards science. I mean, you have to be very careful of that. Because then you're playing into the old rhetoric, you know, all Southern Christians are stupid and won't listen to Darwin or that kind of thing. And those kind of categories just really don't work when you press on them historically.
Yes, you mentioned that the lay public did not have the opportunity to go into the depth.
Yeah.
Now, did either side use catchphrases or slogans to try to make their point?
Oh, yeah.
What would be some examples?
Good examples. Well, actually, some of the rhetorical techniques I talked about were almost stereotyped. That in the past, infidel sciences have always lost out, so polygenism will lose out eventually. and repeat it, and it can be reduced to a sentence, and so it'll almost lead an article. We've had these problems in the past. Science seems to undermine the faith. It always wears out. This is going to happen again. Or the scientists preaching these things are dilettantes. That becomes a catchphrase. They don't really know what they're talking about. Of course, Agassiz a problem. So it does get reduced to almost, you know, the bumper sticker thing to a certain extent. Now, this may be a prejudice of mine. It doesn't happen as much as it does today. They didn't have tweets in those days. We really do have a bad habit of carrying out important debates in bumper stickers and tweets and slogans rather than actual intellectual development. Some of these articles really are very impressive. I forgot to tell you. Thomas Smith's book, one of the first book-length refutations of apologism, comes out in 1850. It first appears in newspapers. Six newspapers, three of them in Charleston, others in the South, serialized this book in 23 segments, filling the entire front page for 23 consecutive weeks. It's the entirety of the book. So that is a serious treat. Now, that's not all the papers. A lot of the papers begin extracting bits from Smith. Bachman gets filtered to a lot of people through Smith. But yeah, some of the depth is really amazing. It is. But still, they're reaching common folk who don't have the background to really deal with it in great detail. And again, it varies. An article in Boston could be a lot more detailed than an article in, what would be a good example, in Cincinnati at that time, although Cincinnati wasn't far behind.
So one last quick question. You may or may not know about this. In terms of the evangelical pulpits, do the preachers sort of mirror what they're seeing in the weekly news papers?
I haven't looked at many sermons. I've looked at a few. Sermons are very hard to research because they're not, people are not going to tell you what the content of the sermon is. Yeah, it's very difficult. Well, even the recorded ones, it's often, how do you know what's in it until you've read it? And how many thousands do you have to read? However, most of the editors of these newspapers are clergy. And they see it a way, now, there's an interesting cultural shift, and I need to stop soon. Before this cheap media, communications media, is available, churches are media. When you attend church, you also get announcements from the pulpit about everything else that's going on in the life. That's how things are communicated, is the church is also the communal center. Once the print media becomes cheap enough that it starts carrying the general communication of what's going on in the world, I suspect that happens less and less in the church, which is why I think a lot of clergy go into the newspaper business. Because they can use, in a sense, the instrument of general communication to keep their message going. And my nickname for these newspapers is the pulpit department. They're taking their clerical ministry into the home through the newspapers. And so the newspapers cover all kinds of stuff, because they have to be newspapers, but they also cover the stuff that these people want to get in there. So I think, in a sense, in the newspapers, we're seeing something about what would be happening in the pulpits as well. It would be almost impossible to really research this thoroughly using sermons. And how do you find the right ones?
Let's thank Dr. Nelson. Okay, so if you're interested in some sample copies,